Hi, my name is Jay Washburn.
And I'm Joe Bondosky.
And this is Start Writing.
I feel like you're being very deliberate with your name now. It's like it's changed. You should say I'm Jay Washburn and now it's I am Jay Washburn.
You know what? I think I said that intro so exactly the same for so many episodes that I'm like trying to think of different ways to say and emphasize.
Was it? I actually listened to podcast Stuff You Should Know, and I think he changes Josh Clark's middle name every time.
Ah, yeah, that'd be fun.
So I think it's kind of a spinoff of Psych, where he would change Gus's name. Well, he changed both their names every time.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, that's funny. I like it.
All right, so today we are going to be talking about in medias res or starting in the middle, but we're not just talking about it. What we're doing is we're talking about a specific story theorist, Lisa Krohn. So we mentioned that this was something we'd be doing. So this is kind of the start of that. We'll still have other episodes that are just more of a general approach to topics we haven't handled before. But so we'll deal with specific theorists. And so you may even disagree because there'll be theorists who disagree with her on certain elements. So, and that's fine because this is her approach, you know, and other theorists will recommend differently. So we do want to point that out going in. So this week in critiques, I was watching Star Trek The Next Generation, the very first episode, and in the opening scene, Captain Picard is walking through the ship and it's with his voiceover narrating and he's just talking about the ship and crew. And this goes on for 5 minutes. Now, that may not sound like very long, but let me point out to you that these episodes are just under 50 minutes, which means that is 10% of the show, where he's just talking about his crew and the new ship that he's got. But I'm going to go further than that and say this is a television show, which means it's competing against other television shows. And while this show is 50 minutes, a lot of those other shows are 20 minutes, the half-hour block ones. That means it is one-fourth of their competition, and it is dull with no dramatic moments. Like,
wait, so did that end up being important later? Like, the crew was newbies, and so they messed up?
No. What? None of it was essential. It was a huge gamble on their part, I think. It was a brand new show. It's the first episode, right? I mean, if you're watching like an episode of Friends, you're a fourth of the way into the narrative by now, right? But here, we haven't started anything. It's just him walking through the ship with voiceover narration talking about it.
Wait, so you said a huge gamble. So the show obviously was very successful.
Yeah.
So maybe the nerds like that.
Tell us about
the nerd stuff that we care about.
I think what it was is at the time, there was almost no television appealing to sci-fi fans. Hmm. And so they had the ads, the promotions, and so people knew this is a sci-fi show for sci-fi fans. And without someone competing in that specific genre, they were able to succeed off of that. Now, I think maybe the show gets better. Maybe it doesn't. I remember it getting better, but I haven't watched it in so long. But
yeah, I liked that show when I was a kid.
I think that first opening, that first 5 minutes, they were able to get away with it because of a lack of genre competition. Hmm. But I don't think you could get away with it now. So that was my This Week in Critiques. So, and then I have a writing truth. This is another one from Tim's book. I pulled several out of there. And so here he says, I smiled out over the lapping water of the bright canal. And what I liked about it was he has the action beat and it just flows right into the description. Just smooth, single sentence. And that was it. Just really simple and effective.
Huh. So let me add a little. I read The Time Traveler's Wife, which again, this was on a sci-fi list, right?
That's a romance.
And I get, well, so I like to think that it's magical realism.
Okay.
And it took me a while into the novel, and I'm like, there's no science in this. They do talk about some chromosomes like a third of the way through, or two-thirds of the way through. But yeah, it's magical realism. And it reminded me, if you read Fahrenheit 451, mm-hmm. about Billy Pilgrim, he says, I became unstuck in time. And it's, man, which I think is a great book, by the way. But this author basically took that concept of becoming unstuck in time and says, okay, what would that be like in a very real, gritty, like practical application of that concept of being unstuck in time. And this whole novel boils out of that one little concept, which I thought was super cool. But it, like you said, it's a romance. It's magical realism. It's not really sci-fi. So it wasn't quite what I was led to believe I would be reading. So again, that pinning the genre, I think, can be a big deal.
Yeah.
I wanted to point out, oh, so there's a moment. This is a spoiler. If you're going to read it, you need to skip ahead 20 seconds. But so Henry is the time traveler, and his mother dies at a point, which is covered. But rather than having him live through it, which he time travels, so a lot of the sequences are out of order, and you're in his shoes experiencing it. But as they show his mother's death, which is like really key to him, he's not in it. He's describing it to his beloved, the time traveler's wife. And so it shows you that this is a romance. Like you said, it puts the emphasis on the characters because he's sharing with her. He's relating the experience rather than living the experience. And I thought that was just an interesting distinction to put the emphasis on the romance and not on the character alone.
So your critique was it was off genre, misrepresented that way?
I don't think that was the author's fault. I read that in a list of a guy who he said, these are my top sci-fis. And Ringworld was on there too, which I read last week. And I'm like, this just wasn't what I was expecting. Still a good book, but anyway.
Starting in the middle or in medias res, via Crone Theory.
In media res.
In media
right?
res?
Yeah, I think so.
You've probably heard the term before, like writing teachers throw it out, because it's been a part of storytelling that long. It's been a part of storytelling that long that we know that you want to start deeper in, closer to the action. So when you're writing fiction, you are competing with everything else the world has to offer. Television, movies, video games, friends, concerts, work projects, other side hustles that people are working on. And Crone puts it this way. In order to distract us from the relentless demands of our immediate surroundings, a story has to grab our attention fast. And as neuroscience writer Jonah Laharan says, nothing focuses the mind like a surprise. We crave the notion that we've come into a crucial junction in someone's life, and not a moment too soon. What intoxicates us is the hint that not only is trouble brewing, but it's long-standing and about to reach critical mass. This means that from the first sentence, we need to catch sight of the breadcrumb trail that will lure us deeper into the thicket. Simply put, we are looking for a reason to care. So for a story to grab us, not only must something be happening, but there also must be consequences we can anticipate. When you read that, it sounds incredibly complex. How do I get all of that into my opening? But we'll go through some examples pretty soon here. But it's that last piece of advice that I find the most potent to me, and that is, but there also must be consequences we can anticipate. Because I think it's fairly easy to write a scene that's action driven and the consequences are immediate, but being able to build in those consequences that it will be anticipated much later, I think is a very powerful lure to a reader. Being like, what happens when they have to deal with this at this junction? And so that's definitely something I'm working on in my own writing, is building in these longer anticipation points, this better breadcrumb trail. So for me, I thought that was really potent.
This reminds me, have you seen the movie Maverick?
Yeah.
It's in medias res, followed by a flashback. Is this going to be part of our discussion? Just the flashback aspect is what I'm wondering about. So it starts with him. He's got a noose around his neck and he's sitting on a horse hooked, attached to a tree, right? The bad guys cuss him out and they chuck this gunny sack on the ground and rattlesnakes come out. So like his horse is going to get spooked and he's going to get hung. And then the bad guys ride off to like leave him to his suffering, I suppose hoping that it'll last a while.
Yeah.
And then he says, it's been a crappy week for me. And he jumps back.
I think that fits perfectly. We're in the middle of it, and it's catchy. Be like, oh my gosh, he's gonna die. Yeah. So we have this consequence we can anticipate, and then he says, "Let me show you the breadcrumb trail." Right.
And interestingly, it makes you very curious how he could have possibly gotten in that situation. So you know, you suppose you know what's gonna come, which is he's gonna die, right?
Yeah.
But it's harder to figure out how the heck did he get in this spot?
Yeah.
And so they jump back and start to tell you that story, which you want to know.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it fits. All right. So then she breaks down this beginning into three essential components. And these are, whose story is it? What's happening here? And what's at stake? And we'll look at each of these as to why it is. So I'm going to take a brief tangent here and go back to patterns and breadcrumbs. So she mentions this trail, and this is the reference to the fact that we see patterns in everything. We've mentioned this briefly before in other podcasts, right? We see shapes in clouds. They look like animals and people, right? I mean, people see faces in bread crust and potato chips, you know, because our brains are wired to look for these patterns. They're looking for them all the time, even when we're not trying to. They just do it. That's how we're wired as people, is to look for these kinds of patterns. One of the great famous examples is the green crabs off the coast of Japan that look like they have the faces of samurai warriors in them. Mm-hmm. And one of the theories behind that is that when these fishermen off Japan would see them, they saw this face similar to a samurai warrior, and they would throw them back, and it made it more similar and more similar over time, right? Mm-hmm. Because they saw the pattern, and then they enhanced the pattern. See, there it is. Ha, ha, ha.
The heck.
Yeah, see? It looks like that samurai warrior. It's actually the back of the crab, not the front, but it looks like a human face there.
Man, it always surprises me that you put two dots and then an arcing line beneath
it. And that's
it,
a face.
And they're like, that's a smiley face. This is a happy person. And it's just two dots and a curved line.
Yeah, it's that pattern seeking. And so she talks about the importance of, because our brains are doing that, it's very satisfying if there is something there for it to find, if you've built those deeper patterns in, because the brain's doing that all the time, right? So as readers, we eagerly probe each piece of information for significance, constantly wondering, what is this meant to tell me, even at that subconscious level, as we like searching for those faces. It said people can go 40 days without food, 3 days without water, and about 5 seconds without finding meaning in something. Right? I mean, think about just listening to the radio, particularly if you're dealing with a difficult issue in your life. It feels suddenly like the radio is talking to you, giving you advice. It's not, but we can't stop ourselves.
Yeah.
But like I said, it can then be deeply satisfying if there's something there to find. We are always looking for the why beneath what's happening on the surface. So like I said, this is far more interesting if there are actually patterns there to follow. So for story to grab us, not only must something be happening, right, Maverick on the horse hanging, but also there must be a consequence we can anticipate. Going down to the essentials, whose story is it? It's the protagonist. So we'll talk about why this is. And so Crone does put a heavy emphasis on the protagonist. And I'll point out again, there are genres where this is less the style as far as the opening of the book goes. Like we've talked about, thrillers usually don't open with the protagonist. That's not how a thriller opens. And so there are genres where this breaks the rules. There are great books for this where they're not following this. But again, this is her theory on story in general. And so she is saying you always start with the protagonist. This is not only the window and how people see it, but it also tells them how to feel about it. Because the protagonist will have feelings about these events, because they're going to be important events to the protagonist. If they're not, they don't belong in the book, right? And so the protagonist is going to have emotional reactions to this, and that is what then tells the reader how to react emotionally. And before you have that protagonist, you don't have that element of structuring that. And so she's saying you start with that protagonist.
I really like that. In spite of the fact that thrillers break it, I think they break it to their detriment, personally.
Is possible. So, but So she says, but here's something writers often don't know. In a story, what a reader feels is driven by what the protagonist feels. Story is visceral. We climb inside the protagonist's skin and become sensate, feeling what he feels. Otherwise, we have no port of entry, no point of view through which to see, evaluate, and experience the world the author has plunked us into. In short, without a protagonist, everything is neutral. And we'll see it in chapter 3 in a story, as in life. There's no such thing as neutral, which means we need to meet the protagonist.
Man, interestingly, I thought of the first Harry Potter book.
Which, that doesn't start with the protagonist.
Yeah, not exactly. It's somebody carrying the protagonist, but yeah. We're not really empathizing. I guess we sympathize, though. But, yeah, it doesn't exactly follow.
Yeah. So, here's some examples. The big picture, this is talking about stakes, the third element. The big picture cues us into the problem of the protagonist we'll spend the story struggling with. For instance, in a classic romantic comedy, it's will boy get girl? Thus, we gauge every event against that question, right? So now we're talking about these breadcrumbs, deeper meaning, right? Our brains are looking for that deeper meaning. And if we know this is will boy get girl, then suddenly every interaction between these two characters or other characters that could impact that relationship has deeper meaning, right? They talk to the waiter and it's like, are they flirting with the waiter? Maybe they're not as interested in their date or not, you know? Mm-hmm. They meet a stranger because they got a flat tire and they need help. Be like, are they going to end up hooking up? Will that ruin the relationship between these two? Every interaction with a possible romantic partner has this suddenly deeper meaning because you can see how it could impact them and have later consequences you can anticipate.
Right? Man, that's so cool. And just like to think of the opposite of some guy talking with a waitress but who's not in a romantic relationship and doesn't care about romance. It's just flat. It's like completely empty. But yeah. If you have that question in mind.
Yeah, you have the stakes. That's
crazy.
Yeah,
that's cool.
So the stakes give us that context to look for that deeper meaning. The protagonist lets us know how to feel about it. So we sit here at the restaurant and we are, let's say the waitress is a very pretty girl. It's a date between these two guys. The POV of the male could be that he's just being polite. But if you roll the same chapter from the POV of the girl, she could be getting jealous and think he's flirting, right? Same events play out. Hmm. That protagonist, again, tells us how to feel. And maybe we even go to the guy and he's thinking, I should have asked out that waitress. You know, like can dramatically impact how this whole scene rolls out and how we are going to feel about the scene, depending on which protagonist we're put into in that moment. Because it tells us how to feel. So here's another example, which is, this one's kind of the whole package. So Joel Campbell, 11 years old at the time, began his descent into murder with a bus ride. So we are on the bus. There's gonna be a murder. And Joel Campbell is our point of view protagonist.
He's a kid. Yeah, that's crazy.
So immediately it answers all those three questions. Whose story is it? Joel Campbell. What's happening here? He's on a bus, which somehow has triggered what will result in murder. And what's the stake? Joel's life, someone else's life, and who... You know, and so all three are just laid out in that single sentence. You started a story.
Is this from a book or did she make that up?
I think she made that up.
Okay, yeah, wow.
Just
She writes the book.
But yeah, so, you know, we talked when we opened, it just sounds overwhelming to address all of this in the beginning. And you start thinking, how can I cram all that into my first page? She puts it in a sentence for you,
yeah.
You know, just smooth and beautiful. The concept of what's at stake is really about giving context and meaning to the story. Within the brain, things are always evaluated within a specific context. It's context that bestows meaning, and it's meaning that your brain is wired to sniff out. So like I said, we talked about the romance story and how it's changed. The minute you know it's a romance story, right? If we don't tell you that and it's just two people having dinner, are they brother, sister? Are they on a date? You know, is this a job thing? Is one a boss and one a subordinate? We don't know. And without that, we can't read deeper into the interactions of the characters. She points out this example of knowing when it's not working, when you don't have these three elements working for you. And here's just a few telltale signs that a story is going off the rails. We have no idea who the protagonist is, so we have no way to gauge the relevance or meaning of anything that happens. We know what the protagonist's goal is, but we have no clue what inner issues forces him to deal with it. So everything feels superficial and rather dull. We have example three. This is a longer example, so I'm not going to read the verbatim. But this is Antonio Damasio, and this is his literature model. And so what he talks about is your brother calls you up and asks you to have lunch and discuss your sister's inheritance and some of her recent strange behavior. So we go there to the scene, right? So, and you can imagine this as a movie. There's these two guys having lunch, and there's a big inheritance that is coming to the sister if they agree to give it to her. But they're worried about her behavior. So in this moment, we are going to be looking at flashbacks and memories of when they were younger and more recently and seeing if there's changes. And if we look at the mind of the character, if this is a novel, then we can go into their thoughts and their feelings about the sister that aren't connected to specific events. And without the context that this is what you're discussing, without knowing that this is about the inheritance that she'll receive and he's concerned she's acting strangely, then it's just a series of memories about this one person. But as soon as you have that context, it all makes sense why this character's thinking about all these different things. And that point of context actually only needs to be discussed probably twice, once in the beginning and once when you circle around back at the end to make a decision. But it structures the whole event. And then Crone addresses the issues. She does address this a little bit of talking about what happens if you have events playing out before the attack and protagonists arrive. So she does address this, even though it's not what she really recommends. But if you're writing in this style, she says, in other words, even when the protagonist doesn't appear on the page, on the first page, everything that happens before he shows up must occur with a clear eye towards how it will affect him when he finally ambles in, right? So even if he's not there, everything will impact him the moment he arrives.
And this discussion makes me want to really focus on the first sentences of the books that I'm working on. Well, for the whole book, but also for each chapter. And make sure each chapter is doing this.
Right.
Pointing to this upcoming structure.
So there's an author, R.A. Salvatore, and he writes the books about the drow elf Drizzt. So if you're familiar with D&D, you're probably familiar with Drizzt. He appears all the time.
Wait, so Drizzt is a character in D&D the game?
So the world of D&D, which is a game, but it is very much a narrative world as well, has a race of people called drow. And a story was created about a specific drow elf. Hmm. And his novels were so popular that he then got adapted into almost all versions of the game.
And so does R.A. Salvatore license this character and then write novels? Or how?
Well, I think he licensed the rights to write in the D&D world. Okay. And then they licensed the character back.
Okay, cool. Sorry for that. It's interesting to me.
So that's my nerd. So anyway, one of the things he does is when he starts a chapter, he starts in medias res. Almost always you're going to start with dialogue between two characters. And then about half a page in, you get exposition of how we got here. And then the rest of the scene plays out. So it was a very interesting technique I saw in his writing. Just in summary here, where are my notes? In summary, these are the three things in the beginning you need. Someone to have an emotional reaction to events and tell us how to feel, the protagonist. A context to understand the meaning behind all the events, that's the stakes or the big picture. And then something to get us interested, what's happening right now. Hmm. And so that's Crone on starting in the middle. And the really unique point of her approach to starting in the middle is the big emphasis on creating context. I thought that was very different from a lot of other story theorists and very interesting.
That's good stuff.
Yeah. So, as always, we would love if you would leave us a review. Tell your writer friends about the podcast. Email them. Text them. Whatever. Put it on Facebook. Wherever you can to let them know about it. If you enjoy the show, check out one of our books and leave us a review on the book you check out. That would be wonderful. We would love it. You can get the keywords on the website. So the new keywords coming out in April will be password locked. The rest are going to remain unlocked as we promote this program and try to let other people know about it.
Guys, and these keywords, this is like between 10 and 30 hours of work, depending on how many keywords you end up using.
But yeah.
Like, this is a valuable thing.
If you have any suggestions, Chris Hawkins actually wrote in and requested an episode on writing groups, which we're working on right now. So thanks to him for that. And we'll get that out fairly soon. And yeah, feel free to sign up for the newsletter, get access to the new keywords and all the other things that go into it.
Thanks, guys. It's time to start writing.